Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water blessed by St. Keurig, and I have a very special union member with us today to help me plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Our guest today is an editor and host of the XP Love Cat YouTube channel. Welcome to the show, Leslie Horn.
Thank you so much. Yes, I'm Leslie. I love role-playing games. I have a channel all about them, and I'm excited to be here.
I am so glad that you came on the show. I'm going to have a link to your show in the show notes. And the reason that I discovered you was a friend of mine, Carl Rodriguez. He was planning on running, or he is running Masked Narlahotep right now. And so he shared your channel and your discussion of like the whole Masked Narlahotep campaign. And I was just so enthralled. And I was like, I need to talk to XP Love Cat. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a series that was what I wanted when I was preparing the game. It's like, okay, I didn't exactly get anything that was that extensive. So I'm like, I'm going to put it out there for people as a resource.
To me, I was like, yes, this is all the sorts of questions that I had, especially as I was like, you know, reading through the chapters and everything like that. I definitely want to talk about that down the line. But first, I was curious. So how did you get into role-playing games? And, you know, after that, how did you get into Lovecraft?
Yeah. So role-playing games, I actually started in college. My now husband got me into them by running a Dark Heresy short campaign for a group in college, and that kind of got me hooked immediately, learning about being creative in a different fashion but also super social at the same time. So I feel like it was a quick way to shortcut making friends, because when you spend time around a tabletop table with people, it's like a connection that happens a lot quicker, I think, than other areas of life sometimes. So that was really where I got into it. And the Lovecraft stuff, I mean, I think I had some knowledge of it before college, but I wasn't really that intensively into the lore. But the Eldritch Horror / Arkham Horror board game was, I think that was probably like my main big exposure to everything. And I was like, this is very cool. And then I also played the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game shortly after that. And so then that opened a whole world for me. And then I started reading in his stories after that. So it was through tabletop gaming that I actually got into Lovecraft stuff.
Okay. That's interesting, because that's kind of almost how I got into it. I got into it through Army of Darkness, which brought up the Necronomicon.
Okay.
And then I found out that there's like this role-playing game, and I didn't really know anything about role-playing games previous to that. So that was, but I talked I talk a little bit about that on one of my podcast episodes, in case anybody's interested in hearing about how I got into it. But, So did you know about Warhammer, like 40K and all that kind of stuff before you started playing the role-playing game? Or was your husband like, hey, we should play this role-playing game, you'll love it?
He was definitely like, this is a cool game, you should play it. And definitely downplaying how much he loved Warhammer 40K. He was playing it very cool. And then I quickly learned that this is something he's very passionate about. And I also enjoy it, but I'm not as deeply in the knowledge and lore of that universe, because there's a lot to learn.
Yeah. Does he play the miniatures too? Or
yeah. He mostly does Kill Team, okay, which is like a smaller scale version So I get roped into playing that sometimes, which is fun, but
okay, cool. So when, once you did get into Lovecraft, what was like, what do you consider to be one of your favorite stories?
I think my favorite is The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And that's because it's just, okay, number one, deep ones are awesome. So let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that story does a really good job of pacing and tension.
Right.
And so it, like that scene when he's in the hotel room and the villagers are coming after the protagonist, that is a very good, like, oh, I'm actually feeling scared moment. And I also feel like that's one of his stories that is more accessible. So when I am talking to people who may have not read any of his stuff before, that's always my recommendation of where to start.
Yeah, I agree. That is probably my number one Lovecraft story. I'd say probably Whispers in the Darkness is probably my second. And I mean, Call of Cthulhu is kind of a classic, but it does, it, I feel like it takes a little bit and it kind of goes in a weird direction at some points where you're kind of like, where, what is happening in this story?
Exactly. So, where am I?
Yeah. But yeah, that's cool. Have you played the Escape from Innsmouth scenario for Cthulhu?
I have not. Is this like for the role-playing game?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So there, it's called Escape from Innsmouth and it happens right after that story takes place. So it's part of the, and I have a feeling that Chaosium is going to be reprinting it very shortly because they're putting out the Innsmouth book, like as part of like the Lovecraft Country. So hopefully, I'm hoping that's going to be a part of it and it's not just going to be like Innsmouth by itself. But if you get a chance to run it, like I'm telling you, you would probably love it.
So. Okay. That's awesome. One of the scenarios that I love, that's very old is the horrible something on Mohican Island.
Yep, I know what you're talking about. I can't remember. Yeah, I don't remember what it's called, but it's something like that.
And it is, it's Innsmouth vibes. It's not like specifically set in Innsmouth. It's set on an island off the coast of Maine. But it has really creepy, similar feel to the Shadow Over Innsmouth story. And so I really enjoy that one too.
Okay.
The Horrible Secret on Monhegan Island. There it is.
There you go. do you live like on the East Coast or do you have like East, like?
No, so I'm from Ohio, but I did actually get to visit that island after I ran the scenario. We were going on a trip, just a vacation to Maine. And I'm like, well, we are here and I want to go. And it's a very small, lovely island for hiking. And it was very fun that I got to visit.
That's amazing. So you started your YouTube channel in 2020. At least that's what I had noted. What motivated you to get into like making content specifically? Because it seems like, you know, you have a passion for horror role playing. You have a passion for Cthulhu, Lovecraft stories. What and game mastering. So what was it that like motivated you to go down this route of creativity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's kind of like a nebulous, messy answer because I feel like it wasn't a decision that was concrete and organized when I did it. And it was like at that moment in time, I was pretty creatively starved in my day job. And so I wanted something to do, something that kind of brought in some of my passions. And the channel originally started as a short Lovecraft short story, like review channel. So I have maybe three or four videos on that, not very many, because it very quickly shifted into role-playing games. And specifically the Call of Cthulhu RPGs, where that shift came into play and I started making content on that and I'm like, oh, I really like this. And that's the direction my channel ended up going. But if anyone's bored, you can go look at my channel, at my oldest videos, and laugh at the terrible quality, which I like to laugh at sometimes, and get some Lovecraft short story reviews.
Oh, I was looking at them. I thought they were really good. So,
oh, thank
I
you. Mean,
you can definitely see the evolution of your channel. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's normal for any kind of content creator. So you're learning as you're going along, right? Mm-hmm. At least that's how I feel.
And the YouTube learning curve is huge, by the way. I had no idea what I was getting into when I first started, because I think like you can definitely get away with just recording on your phone, posting kind of thing. But particularly in the last like 10 years, the quality of YouTube, the caliber of content on YouTube has increased so much that it's very hard to compete when you're doing bedroom recordings, low editing stuff versus what's out there now.
Do you have a high-end kind of setup now, or?
So my version of high-end is a sound panel. You can see one there, but there's sound panels around this room. This is my recording room. And I have a camera now. I have lights. I have a tripod, all that stuff I didn't have when I first started. I just had my phone and a chair. So in that sense, yes, I've definitely upgraded. And now I use video editors. I edited my own videos for a very long time, but then it became a bottleneck because it takes so much of my time. And there's really talented people that are way better at video editing than I am. So off it goes.
Nice. I hope to get there at some point.
Yeah.
So something of an outlier on your channel is you talk about Cyberpunk Red, which, I mean, if you love RPGs, you love RPGs, you probably play a lot of them. But I just found it interesting that it's like, okay, so we got Cult, we had Call of Cthulhu, we had Lovecraft stuff, and then Cyberpunk Red.
Yeah.
So did you always have a love for that genre of, like, you know, the cyberpunk, the Matrix, Johnny Mnemonic type of stuff?
I think my short answer is no. So how this kind of came about was when I go to gaming conventions in person, I generally try to play one RPG system that I've never played before. So that's just a kind of a low effort way to test different systems that I might not have the books for, or might not have the time or energy to try and prepare and learn a new system. But at a con, someone else can do that work for me and I can test it out and see if I like it. So that's really fun. And I highly recommend people do that if they have the opportunity to. And it's also fun to play with different groups and meet different people that way. So Cyberpunk Red was one of those cases is where I played it at a con first, and I really enjoyed the lore, and that then got me into purchasing the game and actually learning more about it and running it.
So when you go to these cons, do you like get all dressed up and do the whole thing, or are you just like, I just go to play the games and hang out and stuff?
I think it's definitely morphed over my time of going to cons. I generally don't dress up because it's too much effort. I did for a couple of years and I'm like, oh man, cons are so tiring to begin with. And then you add the cosplay level. I can't handle that. So I have my t-shirts. I wear my XP Lovecat t-shirts. And it used to be that I was just kind of going more casual, going for the gaming. But now I have met a lot of people through cons and they've become more of social opportunities to see people that I see once or twice a year. So this year was the fifth Chaosium Con, and I've been fortunate enough to go all of those years. And this year was like everywhere I turned, I knew someone and I wanted to talk to someone. And it was a very different experience than like my first year going.
Like, have you made inroads with people who work for Chaosium and like, her name is slipping my tongue right now. I want to say it starts with a B.
Bridget.
She's Bridget.
Bridget Jeffries, yeah.
Yeah, have you met Bridget?
Of course. She's nice. Wonderful and amazing, and I love her.
That's awesome.
So Chaosium Con in particular, it is a smaller convention, which allows you to have those opportunities to get to meet people in the publisher world and get that more human connection. Now, like Gen Con, which is a giant convention that I go to every year, I get kind of surface level if I'm just going to someone's booth and I have some conversation, but it's definitely not as much of a social environment as some of the smaller cons. So I think that's also something to consider if you are like delving into this convention thing, is what type of convention are you looking for? Are you looking to make connections with like industry people and have conversations that are a little bit more in depth? Or are you looking to just enjoy gaming, having fun, looking at different games that are coming out this year? And that will determine what would be like a better fit convention-wise.
Do you run your own games when you're there, or do you just basically go to talk to people and play games and just kind of look at more of a vacation kind of thing?
Yeah, that's also changed because I try not to schedule myself too much now because there are more people that I will just randomly run into and want to spend time with. So I don't plan any games now for the last like 2 or 3 years that I've gone. Yeah, that's my short answer, I guess, is I don't really plan to play because I don't have time to play. And then I'm also fortunate that I get the opportunity to be on panels. And so that's taking up time as well.
What kind of panels do you do when you're there?
So this year I did one on community content creation, which is basically for Chaosium. They have different programs depending on the role-playing game where independent people can publish on DriveThruRPG and Chaosium gets 50% of the profit and the writer gets 50% of the profit. So for Call of Cthulhu, that's called the Miskatonic Repository. So I led a panel with people who have published there to talk about their work and how people can get into writing for these games.
Do you have any tips that you could offer the people listening now, or would that be too?
Yeah, no, I think my biggest tip is to join the community. So we have a Facebook group and a Discord server, and we also have the Miskatonic Repository Con, which is a free online convention in October that I help to organize every year. And you can, if you don't want to write games, you can still come and play for that convention. And there's a bunch of people who are either playtesting games or playing games that they've already published on the Miskatonic Repository. But if you're interested in writing, that's a super great opportunity to come and ask questions and connect with people who have done it so that you can learn about what it's all about. So yeah, join the community. And then you can also check out what people have published on there already to get a sense of what even this type of endeavor could look like for you.
Do you see like what contributes to making a successful module, and you know, like what kind of tips you would offer towards like somebody who was like, okay, you should probably focus on these kinds of ideas when you're trying to write something?
Yes. Okay, so I have done a lot of editing for people who publish on the Miskatonic Repository, so I'm very intimately familiar with what makes a good scenario and what performs well. There are different levels of how many sales you have, like Electrum Seller is what they call a high-selling scenario on the DriveThruRPG. And so I've had a couple scenarios that I've edited that have hit that high-seller mark, which is amazing. And because it's pretty competitive for the browsing, there's a couple things for marketing that are important, particularly when you're thinking about your cover image. We do still buy with our eyes first, so paying attention to cover art. And that doesn't mean that you have to pay for a cover artist, but it does mean that you need to be strategic about making sure that your cover is intriguing. But in terms of the actual content of the scenario, I think it's very important to make it easy for the GM to prep and that they have all the resources that they they need in your scenario. And I think that's not necessarily a rule for drive-through RPG specifically, but just role-playing games, writing across the board, like that is one of the most important things, is at the GM is able to prepare this without a headache and cursing and throwing it across the room, which I've had some experiences with that. And also at the table, the accessibility to find information quickly if they don't remember something.
One of the things that you have a website for is that you are an editor and book coach. How did you come about doing that? Is this part of like your day job kind of thing, or is this something that you moonlight as, or?
Yeah, good question. So I started this, I fell into this as well. It started with playtesting board games at Gen Con, actually. So Gen Con has a specific, like, massive playtesting thing where you can go and test games at different stages of development. And I'm like, this is really interesting to me. And it led me to trying some playtesting for role-playing games. There wasn't a ton of people really looking for that at the time that I was getting into it. But then it led me down the path of editing and learning about the different kinds of editing. I very quickly learned that I liked the developmental editing side of things, which is much more about the content, developing ideas, making sure it's fun for players, making sure it's easy for keepers to run, making sure that it is formatted in a way that is easily digestible and that it's working with the system's rules and not against them. So all that stuff is really, really fun for me. The grammar, punctuation stuff, not my thing. I don't do it. So, like, it's also important if you are looking to get into role-playing game writing and you want to hire some help, that there are different types of editors as well. So in terms of, like, how I actually started getting into editing, well, first, when I discovered I liked doing it, I took a lot of classes to try and learn what I was doing, because before that, I had a career in finance, which is something very different. and I did, so I was educating myself. I did a lot of free work to gain my skills and kind of figure out, okay, what exactly am I doing? Get some word of mouth going. And it was helpful at that time because I was very unsure of myself. So then getting positive feedback from the clients that I was working with, they're like, oh no, you actually like know what you're doing, was helpful for me to gain confidence before I actually started selling my services. So I did that for a while on the side of a full-time job. And then I left my job in November of 2023 and worked part-time for a year. And I've been full-time since January.
Oh, wow.
Editing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So is there a big difference between like being an editor and the book coach, or like?
Yeah, good question. So editing is much more of a solitary, like I am reviewing what you've already put together, and there might be some collaboration going back and forth for revisions, but book coaching is much more collaborative and phone calls and working together and problem solving things, and generally starts earlier in the process. So editing really only comes in when you have a draft written, but coaching can start when you have an idea and you have nothing written. So the coaching I do more on the fiction side. So I also do editing and coaching for fiction, mainly horror, sci-fi, and fantasy genres, just because that's what I enjoy the most and are the most well-versed in. And that's for both novelists and short story writers. So that coaching is much more like, I call it a personal trainer for writing. So it's someone that's going to help you through the process and help you develop ideas and make sure that you're getting feedback along the way. as you complete something, because writing is actually very difficult and keeping the motivation is very difficult. So that's where a book coach can come in.
Nice. I never thought about it like that, but that makes a lot of sense to have somebody there who can kind of put you in the right direction, kind of give you, I guess, the right tools or the right direction to sort of, you know, get yourself into gear, getting writing, and then getting that project sort of from beginning to end kind of thing. So
exactly.
That's really cool.
And particularly on both sides, I also have acquired a lot of knowledge of the publishing industry. And so I can also help people navigate the marketing side and navigate how do I publish, because that is something that a lot of people don't have that knowledge. And also more on the fiction side, it's kind of elusive sometimes how things work. On the role-playing game side as well, but I think there's more transparency in the role-playing game space. And so that's also beneficial when you have someone that is connected with other editors and publishers that can actually help you get to where you want to go.
It feels like to me that there's not a lot of avenues when it comes to like where to publish a role-playing game. Like it feels like you really have like either you have the capacity to sell your PDFs yourself, or you put it on something like Lulu or Amazon, maybe, I don't know, but like really like Drive-Through RPG seems to have like the stranglehold on the market. I don't really feel like that's healthy. What's your views on that? And what do you think? Do you think there's an alternative for people who want to get their work published and get out there?
Yeah. So if you're wanting your work published, and you're not wanting to sell it to one of the big names, because that's an option, you can go to and pitch your scenario to or campaign to one of the big name publishers. But if you're not wanting to go that route, you are correct in that Drive-Through RPG is essentially the monopoly in the role-playing game space for actually publishing your work and making money off of it. Because even people who do Kickstarters, which is can be a really great avenue, you are still selling your product through Drive-Through RPG. I don't know that I have a passionate answer for the situation. It does kind of feel like the reality at the moment, but that there's not necessarily a great solution for how to add some competition in the space, because it is a pretty niche thing and would be a very large undertaking for someone to come in and try and be that competitor.
Yeah. Do you see people who get their stuff published on the Miskatonic repository who then are approached by Chaosium, or who they're able to approach Chaosium and say, hey, I have this stuff, this is my work, that have been like successful getting their foot in the door that way?
Yes, the answer is yes, because Chaosium does hire freelance writers to write for their books. So that's more often the case is, hey, I have published this thing, do you like my writing? And then they hire you to write one scenario for them. So it's not as much of the please buy my stuff that I've already written, but you may get hired as a freelancer. And then I know there is one person in particular, and he wrote I have the cover in my head, a Japan scenario with Mount Fuji. I'll have to try and uncover this, but he has a pretty strong partnership with Chaosium, and has published a lot of really high quality stuff. And I don't know the details behind it, but I know that they have a partnership of some sort. So I think there are certainly avenues for that opening doors for people. But I will also say I have heard from others that just posting and doing their own stuff on the repository has been better than they thought it would be. And that is what they want to spend their time doing, is just staying on the repository.
So you talked a little bit about having like a passion for science fiction and horror and fantasy and stuff. So what would be some of the books that you're into, or authors that you're into? that not necessarily like Cthulhu related, but.
Yeah. Okay. So one of my favorite recent reads was The Ferryman by Justin Cronin. And I think he is a very talented writer in general. So he does more of the sci-fi stuff. And I would definitely recommend that people check him out. Okay. I also, and I know you said it doesn't have to be Cthulhu related, but I just finished The Cult of the Spider Queen.
Oh, cool.
So there's a whole line of Arkham Horror books that is published by Aconite. They do a lot of tie-ins to different game systems. So they have Arkham Horror, but they have like Legend of the Five Rings as well.
Oh, really?
And so these are really, they're just fun. Like these are light, quick, fun reads. And I have quite a few of those.
Interesting. I had no idea that they published their own novels.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah, I would recommend them.
So kind of diving back into the Cthulhu stuff. So when did you start keepering or running Call of Cthulhu? Like, what was your, because you said you started off as a player, you kind of got introduced to Call of Cthulhu. So when did you make the transition from like player to like, I got to do this as a game master or a keeper?
I think it was, I was a player for probably about 4 years before I delved into the game master side. And I was super nervous and I didn't think I was going to be good at it. And I didn't necessarily think I was going to like it. And I think a lot of those things were connected to the just something new, scary, I don't know what I'm doing feeling.
Yeah, I could understand that.
Yeah. Like, oh man, that's kind of a lot of pressure to make sure people have fun. But when you're in a trusted group, I was lucky to have friends that I had been playing with for a while. So it took the pressure off to be super the best at it, because I definitely wasn't very good at it at first, but I did learn that I liked it a lot and I continued to practice. And now I'm like, every time I'm a player, I sometimes think, but what if I was GMing this?
I can relate to that 100%. Yeah. There's something about once you have that taste for running games that you can't help, but it's not that you're being critical of your game master, but it's just like exactly like what you're saying is, man, I wonder how I could have done that. I would have twisted it this way. And then what would have happened? How would my players have reacted or, you know, otherwise?
And so, also I like having secrets. When I have knowledge, I feel powerful. I know something you don't know.
That's interesting. So was Cthulhu what you jumped into? Like, was that the game that you first started game mastering?
Yes, it was the game that I first started game mastering for and what I've game mastered for the most.
Okay. Did you ever play Dungeons & Dragons or anything like that?
We did. I played it. I mean, I've played it on and off for like 15 years-ish, but I have learned that I don't enjoy it as much as other systems, so I don't tend to play that game unless someone's like, I really want to play this specific thing. I'm like, okay, I'll join you. That's fine. But I have found that I just have a preference for indie systems or other systems that mesh more with my genre and style of play.
What kind of indie systems do you gravitate to the most?
Okay, so if I'm doing like one shots, I actually really do enjoy having a very light system that's easy to prep and pick up. There's one called Die Laughing, which is very much like a horror comedy movie, and you're just co-creating scenes with each other, and you know that your character's gonna die by the end. And the funny part is just like, okay, this is silly. I don't get attached to my characters. We're all going to die and we're going to laugh doing it.
Okay. Interesting. I've never heard of that one. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, it's quite fun. And another one similar to that is 10 Candles, which that one you also are going to die, but it has a much more serious tone to it than this die laughing.
Yeah, I've heard of 10 Candles before. That sounds like amazing. I would be afraid of starting a fire, but
I have the electric candlelight because I also don't want to deal with fire. More specifically, the fire alarms. I don't want to have to stop in the middle of the game when my fire alarm goes off.
Good point. So what exactly is it about Call of Cthulhu that you enjoy? Like, that sounds very aggressive. What do you enjoy about the game? But
justify your choice. So the lore is number one. I love the Lovecraft lore. That's what gets me into it. And I think this is one of the systems out there that really integrates it very well. I personally do really like the D100 system. I think Chaosium calls it the basic role-playing game system, which is what they use for all their role-playing games. And it just kind of makes sense in my head to roll a D100, and then what you get is what you get. And it's kind of the right level of crunchy for me for the average experience that I want at the gaming table. So if I'm playing, I play Call of Cthulhu the greatest percentage of time in my role-playing game playing. And that level of, it's not too much that I'm sitting at the table calculating a bunch of things and breaking gameplay, but it's enough that I feel like it supports the game and adds elements of failure. So we don't always win in Call of Cthulhu, and a lot of times we don't win in Call of Cthulhu, and I like that element of it.
How long did it take you until you decided, okay, I'm going to run Masks of Narlahotep? Because I'm sure you're aware of, like, Seth Skorkowski. I mean, he still hasn't run it. He says that that campaign intimidates him. And so I imagine that, you know, like, I felt the same way. I'm getting ready to run it, but I haven't started because I'm just like, I don't want to mess this up, you know? So what was it that you decided, okay, this is it, this is the one, I'm going to do this?
Okay. Well, I was really naive, and I didn't actually know what all went into this when I decided to run it. I was still relatively green in the role-playing game space, so I hadn't been inundated with, like, the weight that comes along with this campaign. I just saw it and thought it was cool. I like Narlathotep as a deity kind of thing in the lore. I think he's really cool. And I was interested to try something different and something more campaign in the Call of Cthulhu system, because I had played other campaigns before, but not in Call of Cthulhu specifically. So I think it was probably like 1 or 2 years after I started GMing the system that I decided to run it. And I'm glad I did, but I also didn't know what I was getting myself into.
Did you start with, like, 5th or 6th edition and then get into 7th, or you started right at 7th edition?
I started in 7th.
Okay. So you had no baggage from, like, previous editions to kind
Correct.
Of... Correct. I know there's not a lot of difference, or at least people say there's not a lot of difference between editions, but I feel like there's still certain people who are like, no, like... 7th edition is a separate entity completely, you know?
Right.
So how did you, I mean, you have a number of videos that you go through and you talk about each chapter, which is fabulous. And you talk about, like, what can you ditch? What should you keep? Why? Mm-hmm. All of these things. I thought they were amazing. How did you manage to stay motivated? Because it took you, what, 2-3 years?
I think 2.5 years. Yeah.
So how did you stay motivated during that time to, like, not be like, ugh, I can't look at this book anymore, or this like double book monstrosity?
Yeah. Okay. I don't think I ever actually had that feeling. And I will give a lot of credit to the production of the upgraded campaign for 7th edition. I did flip through the original campaign book, and like that, I would have needed some motivation hits to like get through.
Okay.
But I felt like the 7th edition version of this campaign was put together very well in terms of ease for information, mm-hmm. and also just the visual look of the book. Like there's a lot of really beautiful art in that mm-hmm. book. And so when I went to pick up and plan this campaign, I was excited because I knew that I would see pretty cool pictures and have fun reading about the story. Okay. Yeah. So I think with this campaign in particular, I don't know that I really felt ever like I didn't want to plan it because I was always interested to know what was coming next and what crazy things I could make my players go through.
Do you remember how much time you would spend like pre-session to like prepare for the, like that week's game? Like, did you spend a lot of time or was it like,
I'm going to guess I probably spent like 6 or 7 hours preparing for each session.
Like per week?
We played every other week. No, not per week, per chapter. So if I'm planning a chapter, 6 or 7 hours for that chapter, and then chapters would take multiple sessions.
Right.
So then at the beginning of a session where we had already started the chapter, it probably only take me an hour to refresh.
I can't remember. Did you use the prop set? The HP Lovecraft.
I didn't, but I've heard really good things about it. I did some stuff on my own to kind of play with props, but it wasn't as awesome as the Historical Lovecraft Society. They put together a really awesome box that I have heard great things about, but I personally didn't use it.
Okay. So was there anything during that campaign where you had like particularly good memories or experiences from that running that campaign over that time?
Yes, lots. We have lots of stories that we bring up to this day about our crazy campaign adventures. But I would say one of the ones that sticks out to me the most is towards the end of the campaign. My players were getting a little loopy and silly, and they decided to play the Scooby-Doo gang, which was absolutely very funny. Daphne did not have a good time. She was given a gun and told that it was a tranquilizer, and it certainly was not. And Daphne rolled really well. And the person on the other end did not survive.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. So these were like replacement NPCs or replacement PCs?
Yeah, we went through a lot of PCs just from player or PC death or insanity. Both of those happened quite a bit throughout the campaign. And then like one of my players purposefully wanted to play a different character in each of the different countries that we went to.
Interesting.
So it was kind of player choice of like, do you want to play someone different? Do you want to keep using your character? So we had a mix throughout the table of what they wanted to do.
How did you find that experience of having different characters, like player characters through the campaign? Because I would feel like you would lose something like that. This has been my biggest concern is like, I'm going to have like a bunch of players die all at once mm-hmm. and then kind of losing that energy and momentum and the clues and all of that kind of stuff to like continue moving the thing forward. So what was your experience like with that?
Yeah. I had grand plans at the beginning of this campaign that I said, take your character notes, and when your character dies, your notes go with them. Okay. And I very, very quickly changed my mind and said, please keep your notes.
So did you do something in game terms, or it was more of like a meta thing? Like you still have this.
It was pretty fluffy because honestly, like we didn't find that part fun to try and like figure out the transition. So we were like, and things happen and you're caught up to speed. Like, that's how I worked it. And that was fine with everyone at the table, because then we were able to spend the majority of our time doing the fun stuff that we wanted to play instead of like figuring out the puzzle piece of how Joe off the street is all caught up on your previous cult dealings.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would probably do the same thing. I feel it's... There's certain, I feel like there's just certain experiences and, you know, attempting to stay to certain realism. It's kind of like when you find when a party member dies in a dungeon and then you're like, oh, and there's a prisoner in the next room. Yes, and you're kind of like, why shouldn't we kill this guy? We tortured the last guy. But no, this guy's a PC. We can't torture the PC. So, yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. So... You talk about Vaisen and cult as well on your channel. Mm-hmm. So I definitely get this theme of like horror and investigative RPGs. What exactly is it about that those genres or that togetherness that you enjoy?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the first thing I think is the pacing, I think, tends to work really well in horror role-playing games in terms of we have the investigation up front and there's this slow ramp up where we're discovering what's actually happening, getting to the climax of, oh, this is a really weird thing that we now know. and so that discovery is really intriguing to me. And then having to deal with this either creature or cult or whatever is happening that I, as the player, probably didn't expect. And then as the GM, getting to see my players be surprised by these things, mm-hmm. I really enjoy that aspect of horror role-playing games. And then the horror genre in general, I think is it's an invasive genre in terms of like emotionally and physically, it's very like in the body sensations.
Mm, interesting.
So when we're talking about like setting the scene as a GM and you hear the tips of make sure you use the senses, talk about what the smell is, what taste is in your mouth, like those things help to bring players and immerse them into the setting and the scene in a way that I think works more effectively and is more enjoyable for me than other genres.
Talking about horror and having that like actual physical feeling. So in 2021, you're diagnosed with thyroid cancer. That's crazy. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how that has changed your view and approach to life now?
Yeah. So it was super duper scary.
I believe it.
I was also pretty young, so I was 28 when I was diagnosed. So although I don't think anyone is expecting like a health crisis like that, mm-hmm. it was like a double whammy almost, like, oh my gosh, this happens, and I'm only 28 years old. What is happening? I'm confused. Yeah. I'm young. I'm also like unsure of myself and my place in the world at that time. So there were a lot of things going on that it was kind of a slap in the face. And I talk about this a little bit on my channel of mm-hmm. how role-playing games were a really helpful hobby to have. I had a pretty intensive surgery. It was a 10-hour surgery to get rid of lymph nodes and my thyroid. And so the recovery for that was a lot longer than I was anticipating. But role-playing games, I could sit on the couch and read an RPG book. Yeah, I could do that. Mm-hmm. And the other element of this treatment was something called radioactive iodine. And I had to quarantine in my room for a week and not see people because was radioactive. Which always makes me think of the Simpsons episode with Mr. Burns and he's in the forest, like glowing green. Which is just awesome. Or Radioactive Man, that works too.
Yeah.
Yes, I was radioactive for a week and I played one of the Alone Against the, there's like flames, there's a couple of different versions of those, yes, and they're solo role-playing games for Call of Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to lean on my hobby during that time, which was really great. But I think generally, like, this experience accelerated my career transition that we've already talked a little bit about, of leaving my job where I was creatively starved and not getting a lot of fulfillment into something where I am loving what I do and feeling fulfilled in what I do and happy with the majority of the time that I'm working instead of not.
Right. Would your advice be to sort of pursue those kinds of dreams and 'cause I feel like, especially in this day and age, it's got to be scary. You know, you want to have job security. You want to make sure you're, like, especially if you live in the States, you want to have healthcare and all that kind of stuff. So, like, is that something you're like, nah, man, just do it. Like, you got one life, just go out there and take your shot.
I would say I have asterisks to that. Like, that is my general sentiment, but my asterisk is that you do have to pay the bills, and that's important for mm-hmm. your livelihood and to be able to have the excitement in things, as you do still need to have a safety net. And so, yes, follow your dreams, do it in a way that feels like manageable within your tolerance window, and you can always ease into it. So I did this side work and built on the side for years before I left.
Right.
So it's something that is a very personal question for everyone, but that I think at the end of the day, if you feel like something is tugging at you to do, there's a reason why it's tugging at you, and you should pursue it in a way that you can, whether that is going all in, cool. But if it's not, you can take small steps to get there.
Right. That makes sense. So, like, the hobby has become much more inclusive now in the past 50 years since when it started. Can you talk a little bit about your experience as a woman in the hobby and especially, like, running games and stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay. So I have had very good experiences overall. I would say when I first got into the hobby, I didn't think about it. I generally, I was already kind of used to being in male dominated spaces, again, mm-hmm. with finance. But generally, I have even seen in the last 15 years, an even greater shift in inclusivity and welcoming all different types of people into the hobby. And that's a lot of fun to see. Especially at conventions, just all the different people that you get to meet with different backgrounds. And I think my answer is, I hope it's encouraging to people that I don't have any horror short stories to share around this.
Right.
I generally have found the role-playing game to be very welcoming. And I enjoy having different types of people at the table, because it brings a richness to the experience. Having different people with different backgrounds, role play different characters, have opportunities to learn from each other. I think that's something that's super beautiful about this hobby and this community.
Nice. That's good to hear. I'm so glad that you haven't had those negative experiences. It's something that I think about. Like, now I have a table. I call it my ladies group. There's just basically me and one other dude, and he was kind of reluctant. He didn't actually want to play. But I was like, dude, you can't just sit around the table and like watch us. That's kind of weird. So and it was his girlfriend who was like, hey, could you teach us D&D? Like, I really want to, you know, me and my girlfriends want to learn how to play this game. And I was like, hell yeah. And so I guess maybe, I don't know, I'm a older generation gamer, and I'm like, I just want to make sure that I'm inclusive and open to everybody at the gaming mm-hmm. table, and that it's not weird, which I don't know. That sounds weird to say, but
no, I think it's a great mindset to have of, like, just being aware. And I think I won't harp on it too much because I think it's talked about a lot, but like lines and veils and safety tools are something that's very easy to implement at the table that assures everyone that they're in a safe space. That it we at any time you can stop a scene. The most important thing is everyone is having fun.
It's good advice. So talking about advice, I know we're I'm conscious for time here, but I just wanted to kind of finish up with, you have a lot of great game mastering advice on your channel. Do you have any kind of like one piece of advice that you could offer a veteran or a beginner GM so that, you know, they can get to the table and have one of the best games that they could run?
Yeah. Okay. For beginners, I think it's more of don't put too much pressure on yourself, because the likelihood that people are going to have fun at the game is very high, even if you mess up or even if it doesn't go exactly how you thought it would in your head. And I still get anxious when I run games, and I've been doing it for a very long time. But that anxiety will ease the more you do it. And as you get into a session, it kind of dissipates once you're like, okay, well, we're warmed up here. Everyone's laughing. We're cool. So don't put too much pressure on yourself. And that would also apply to veteran GMs. But my specific advice, I think, for veteran GMs is to try something new. If you've been doing it for a while, try a different system, because you might be surprised. You might pull elements. Maybe you like something about a specific system, but you don't want to play that all the time. You might find elements in that game that you really like and you pull into other systems. So experiment, see what's out there. There's a lot of games that are really cool and awesome to play. And I think it's a great opportunity to just try something different every now and then.
That's awesome. I like that advice. So I just wanted to finish up. Was there anything that you wanted to add or say before I let you go?
I think the only thing is I would love for everyone to check out my YouTube channel. I am currently experimenting a little bit with lore videos. So lore specific to role-playing games. And I'm mostly just curious if people actually like them. So if you want to give me feedback, I'm open to that.
Nice. Well, I'll definitely have a link to your channel. I'm going to have a link to your Patreon and to your editing services. And it's been a super pleasure to have you on the show. You're so full of like exuberance and life. I love it.
Thank you.
I'm glad that you're healthy and that, you know, you've shared all this great information with us. I'm really, really happy to have had you on the show. And who knows, maybe someone listening to this show will one day be using your services to get published on the Miskatonic University's repository, or who knows, a book or whatever. But no, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. That's all we got for today. Till next time, plungers up.
That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. It is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that Linguinion's Jason. If you want to hear more interviews like this one, follow us and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your neighbors, random strangers, the people living in the wall, the troll that lives under the bridge, the guardian of the lost city, everyone! It means the world to us that you share our podcast and make our numbers bigger. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.